translational medicine and regulatory science. Regulatory science is essential in bringing the benefits of therapeutic innovation to patients. It systematically analyzes existing regulatory frameworks, ensuring they evolve to keep pace with scientific advances. This provides a dual benefit of promoting innovation whilst protecting the public health. However, regulatory science faces a new challenge. An understanding of how diseases operate at a molecular or cellular level is replacing our traditional disease definition based on phenotypes and symptom descriptions. This theme explores how existing regulations will need to adapt to recognize these new definitions. It also examines the consequences of these new approaches, particularly in clinical trials, and the role of clinical endpoints versus molecular endpoints. How will regulatory science help drive this change? Hello, I am Alberto Grignolo. I am deputy editor of DAA's Global Forum magazine. I'm here with Dr. Detlef Niese of Dr. Niese Health Science and Policy in Germany. Dr. Niese is co-lead for the DIA 2015 Euro Meetings theme on translational medicine and regulatory science, and I'm excited to have this opportunity to discuss this important topic with him to share with our readership. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Niese.
Welcome.
I would like to ask you the first question, and that is, what specific aspects of regulatory science will need to change in response to our emerging understanding of disease on a molecular level, and why?
Now, the changes we are facing are driven by our emerging knowledge about the molecular origin of disease. While in the past, traditionally, we have focused on description, on phenotypes of disease, and the whole regulatory framework is organized around this understanding of disease. This changing understanding of disease mechanisms has first brought us to the point we actually know very little. And one of the first challenges our regulatory environment and regulatory science plays an important role in this is to bring together the emerging scientific knowledge and understanding and our regulatory frameworks. This sounds simple on the surface. It will change not only the regulatory environment, it will change medicine as a whole, because we're moving from our traditional thinking, which emerged over centuries, into a completely new understanding of disease. And that will drive not only our medical practice, but it will drive regulatory decisions. The current guidelines will no longer be of use in this context.
In your opinion, how will regulatory decisions change in this era that some have called the era of precision medicine?
Precision medicine, personalized medicine, personal health care, targeted medicine, these are all different terms describing the same situation. We are moving away from an understanding of disease categories organized by organ and organ prevalence and certain symptom complexes to a completely new taxonomy of disease, a new grouping, a new classification. And that will be driven by our knowledge about disease mechanisms. To give you an example, in the past, we used to talk about cancer as a whole, or we talked about certain organ cancers like breast cancer. Meanwhile, we have understood there are quite a number of different mechanisms behind breast cancer. And we have identified some of those, only some. And as a consequence, we were able to develop therapies which target exactly those mechanisms. But the most important thing is breast cancer is not one entity. It's a highly heterogeneous group of diseases. As much as it is any other sort of cancer, as it is even diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, you can use whatever you want, we haven't actually come at grips with what's behind it. And we need to come to the understanding that many of the common diseases we talk about are groups of different heterogeneous diseases. And this regrouping of diseases according to new principles will also lead to a new understanding of what will be measured, what will be actually used for decision making, how do we measure efficacy, what are expectable side effects or undesired effects, I prefer to say. So it will be a whole change in our then understanding of medicine. And because regulations don't happen overnight, they emerge over a long period of time, this will be a time-consuming process. In the meantime, we have discrepancies. We have, for example, endpoints which are targeting at a certain symptom complex. And then we have a medicine which targets a certain mechanism. And you see already, to bring these together is very difficult. As a consequence, we are risking losing promising therapies because the current regulatory framework is not going to understand that these drugs actually are doing something useful, because they do that only in a very particular group of people.
What could help enhance the regulatory process and the regulatory understanding?
Now, we talk about regulatory science. And as a scientist, I have to say the foremost, it will be science. And that science is still missing. And the science is the science of molecular disease mechanisms. So what we need in the very first place, we need to intensify our common research efforts in order to really dig into the molecular events behind what we call disease. Many people believe this will be, you know, will lead to a plethora of orphan diseases with very, very few patients in that. But biology is not that redundant. Biology is based on very clear and structured processes, and there is a limited number of those. So we can expect that it's not going to lead to a completely diversified type of medicine. Some people say it will be on the level N equals one. This is not going to happen, I'm absolutely convinced. But what we'll see is, we'll see a regrouping. Like we already see, we now talk about, for example, cancers which are driven by a mutation of a particular centrally regulating protein, which is mTOR. And that leads to cancers in the breast, in the stomach, in the kidney, elsewhere. It actually is also involved in immune response and is critical for organ transplantation. These central mechanisms are not organ-specific, nor are they specific for a very particular group of symptoms. They regulate, in this case, cell growth. And that's a fundamental process involved in many different areas. And if that goes wrong, it can have multiple different consequences. So this is what I'm talking about. It is not splitting into small pieces. It is regrouping. And that will lead to a new understanding also in regulatory affairs and in regulatory sciences. We will move away from an organ-centered medicine, and we will move away from an organ-centered regulatory understanding.
Can you comment on diseases that are the result of a single mutation versus diseases that are associated with perhaps a number of mutations, maybe many mutations? How will that add to the complexity of the regulatory scientific process?
This is definitely one of the greater challenges we are facing. You are certainly right with that question already, and this is the reason why we cannot expect that this is going to change everything in each overnight, and there will be a lot of gaps in our understanding. So there will be many, I would say, symptom complexes, which today we call diseases, that will take a long time until we make them closer. Maybe some people will not be able to unravel. Now, if you talk about the single gene diseases, many of the rare diseases actually are these what we call Mendelian diseases. You know, if you take Huntington's disease, for example, or cystic fibrosis, these are known disorders. They are inheritable and they are focused on a single gene. But we have understood that, for example, and I mentioned this, that certain types of breast cancer or certain types of colon cancer are also caused by mutations, by single mutations, which may not work alone. We haven't fully unraveled this. But we have identified a critical gene which plays a central role in the development of this. So if there is a central regulator of cell growth and cell multiplication and cell replication, and that is mutated and leads to an uncontrolled growth of the cell, we end up with cancer. On the other hand, this is a natural process. And this natural process is critical, for example, for the function of the immune system, because before an immune cell can work, it has to divide. And the same mechanism is involved. So in this case, it is not a mutated gene which can lead to disease, namely organ rejection after transplantation, because that's not a natural process, but a functional gene and a functional process, which also can lead to disease. You see, it is not that simple. It's always about mutations. And that's something we all have to learn. It is not just about genetics. It's about genetics, about epigenetics, about lifestyle, interaction of multiple genes. And what we will see is the consequence of that. So understanding what we call complex diseases, which are caused by the interaction of multiple genes, will be the most difficult thing to do. But we will make progress, I'm sure.
The journey has started, hasn't it?
Has just started.
Let me move to another area, and that is, in your opinion, what role can university and academic research centers play, and what role can medical schools play in advancing these important changes?
No, they have a central role in this. The first and foremost central role is driving the research, because it's research in diseased people. And where are they? In hospitals. And university has the traditional role in unraveling diseases, disease mechanisms, developing new treatments. They always played that central role, and that role is even stronger now. And that's one of the problems. There is a strong focus on certain small aspects. There is a run on unraveling certain mechanisms for cancers. But this is not just about cancer. In fact, we started with cancer in many areas because it's such a burning issue. But the same problem affects all other things. No one knows today why we have certain types of arrhythmia or other heart problems. And they are killing people as well. And we don't know why. So it's not really about that point. And the second part is education. And that's what hasn't started yet. We need to alert our young and students, basically, but all people also in training, that this is moving and this is coming, because medical community is a very conservative community. And I would say that's good, because it would be a drama if doctors would change direction every second. So it's good to be careful. It's like our IT professionals who sure. always work with the four last version of an operating system. So that's okay.
What, given the regulatory challenges that you've already mentioned, what role can the academic centers and the scientists play in perhaps partnering with the regulatory authorities to help, if you will, pave the way for a smoother, more streamlined regulatory process when it comes to translational medicine and precision medicine in the future?
I think this is one of the most exciting developments in not just in this area, but in general. And that you see, that's why we are here in Paris. This is a traditional meeting where scientists, regulators, patient organizations, and industry scientists meet on a neutral ground. And that's perfect. So I would say the Euro meeting is something like a model for what we are looking for. And that is now growing. None of what we have been talking about can be done by any of the stakeholder groups alone. We need an ongoing dialogue, a new knowledge, new information needs to be shared with all the other stakeholders, and that may emerge actually in any of the groups. I think it's absolutely old-fashioned to believe that's always the scientists who will bring forward new knowledge. No, it can be regulators, it can be today patient organizations who play a crucial role, because they bring actually the information from those who are suffering. We have neglected that for so long time, and now we are there, I think. And one of the, I would say, one of the exciting examples of that is a joint program which was triggered by the IMI, the Innovative Medicines Initiative of the European Commission and the research-based industry, which is called UPATI, which educates patient representatives with regard to the drug development process. You see, this is the type of developments we need, and we need to strengthen. In the theme, there will be a whole session dedicated to this interaction, which I think is critical to move this forward.
Let me extend this to another constituency, and that is the healthcare payers. essentially. In Europe and in other parts of the world, there is a great concern about the constraints on healthcare systems and the ability of payers to pay. How do you think the payer community will approach this area of precision medicine, and how will patients have access to these precision medicines going forward if there is great pressure on healthcare systems to contain cost?
First, I think what we need is, and that's a little bit more of a dream, we need a complete change in thinking. We call this what is health technology assessment, and that's what we need. While at the moment I have the impression this is more cost containment authorities rather than health technology assessment. The focus is really on saving cost, but saving cost should be and is a necessary consequence of what we do, but it can't stand at the beginning. So we really have to develop our processes by which we carefully evaluate the value which is brought forward by new treatment approaches, by comparing those. And this is at the moment left to, I would say, very important and very respectable organizations like Cochrane, but these are not regulatory bodies. These are basically, let me call it this way, private organizations. You know, they are not somewhat under a certain type of clear governance. And I think that's what we need to do. The developments we see are perfect, and that is that regulators and health authorities are now joining forces for scientific advice. That's a very good first step. Patient organizations are already involved in this. I think on the science side, on the academic side, these bodies are fairly unknown. And the awareness of academic researchers for exactly what we're talking about, you know, the need for cost control is still limited. There is more of an enemy picture. You know, these are the bad guys who are restricting what we can do. And we all need to understand that's not what it is about. But I think the first and foremost important thing is the HTA authorities have to come to the table. They have started doing that, which is great, and really welcome that. But we are far away from, I would say, where we are with the regulators. Regulators are the mind of everyone. Health technology assessment authorities are more, you know, industry knows about them.
Indeed. Thank you for that perspective. Let me move to a final area, and that is, we are in Europe, but how can these discussions about regulatory science in Europe be helpful to regulatory authorities who work in other areas of the world, particularly emerging economies in Africa, Latin America, and Asia?
I think Europe has to bring a lot. And we are celebrating now 50 years of European pharmaceutical legislation, which I think is an event which I would have loved to see on the front page of our newspapers. You hardly find it there. It is something dramatically important. And these developments, because we didn't start from a unity, we started from diversity. That's in contrast to the US, which started from unity. And therefore, they had not so many challenges in some areas. But the European system is extremely science-based, but it respects diversity. And this is exactly what you can see in other parts of the world as well. So the European system, to me, is a model system which would be useful for many other places in the world. Unfortunately, I was in China and I worked with regulatory authorities there. And they look foremost to the US because for them this is a single block. Exactly. And Europe hasn't really managed yet to transport the message. The European system is a fairly harmonized system which is created out of diversity and is able to live and to support diversity. So particularly for countries which are more diverse and regions which are diverse like Europe is, this to me is one of the role models. And I think it should be on the top of the European policy agenda to use our system as an export article and to alert authorities in other regions. Look, this is something which will be of use to you because it allows you to bundle forces. Why should every small country in Africa which has not even a functional healthcare system? Why should all of them completely build from scratch new regulatory systems, rather than to say we are building a pan-African regulatory system, and we use the European model as an example, which allows sovereign countries to adopt a common regulatory system? Actually, they are doing that already.
Are you familiar with formal outreach efforts by the European authorities towards, for example, the African or Latin American authorities to discuss how perhaps a European model might have some interesting experiences to share?
I have heard about that, but I can't tell you in detail how that is actually working. But I, during one of my visits to Africa, last time was in Kenya, where I worked with a local university on an educational program, I heard from my colleague there that there would be discussions, but I can't give you any more detail. I would love if that would be a real concerted action.
Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Nisa, for taking the time for this important discussion. This concludes our podcast for today. To learn more about this topic or to read the current issue of DIA's Global Forum, please, I invite our listeners to visit www.diaglobal.org. Thank you.
You're welcome.